Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. What's happening to the New England cod population? A new study says stocks have plummeted 80%, but some fishermen disagree.
Everyone that fishes the Gulf of Maine, amateur fishermen that go out for the first time, no one can believe that someone can actually say that this cod stock is not in good shape.
Also today, saving democracy from the polarizing power of social media. And how urgent is the need for new antibiotics? We'll talk to the director of a new biotech accelerator dedicated to fighting superbugs.
So much of modern medicine depends on antibiotics, from cancer treatment to joint replacements to everyday scrapes and bruises. I don't want my grandkids to grow up in a post-antibiotic era.
All that and opening day at Fenway Park.
Finally sunny out, the Sox are back in town. Fantastic. It's going to be awesome.
Coming up next on Radio Boston.
Need tickets? Selling tickets?
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and no snow today, thank goodness. Just beautiful spring weather as fans from near and far, young and old, are at Fenway Park for Red Sox opening day.
My name's Alexis Lewis. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada.
My name's Ricky Lewis. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada. All the way from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Yep.
To see the Sox play here at Fenway. Never been here before. Huge Red Sox fan because we're from Las Vegas and we don't have a team for ourselves. So we adopted the Sox younger years ago, and here we are.
Need tickets? Selling tickets?
My name's Christopher Busa. I'm from South Nashua, New Hampshire.
I'm his son, Paul Busa, and I live in Wakefield, Mass.
It's a tradition that my son and I have been doing for 30 years.
And we've had the opportunity to do this every year. It's something we always look forward to. So no matter what's going on in your world, you know that you have this to look forward to. That's part of the reason that keeps you coming back, other than a joy for the game and to get out here with all the other people who do it every year as well.
My name is Tessie Blake D'Amato. I'm from Vermont.
I'm Emily Blake, and I'm from Vermont.
And this is my first time here,
yeah.
And I'm very excited because I'm just so excited to see Wally's sister that's named Tessie because that's my name.
Fantastic. Guys, enjoy your day. Thank you.
David Littlefield, the sausage guy. We're expecting a great day today.
Why? Finally sunny out. The Sox are back in town. Fantastic. It's going to be awesome.
Absolutely, it's going to be awesome. Sounds of fans from opening day at Fenway Park. And joining us now from Fenway is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, what's going on?
Well, Mookie Betts just got on first base, I think, is what's going on. So fans are hoping that the Red Sox will get on the scoreboard. It's now 0-0, but they're hoping that the Sox will edge a little bit ahead of the Pittsburgh Pirates here.
Well, it sounds like the energy is up at Fenway Park. What's the day been like so far?
I would say yes, the energy is definitely up. People are excited by the fact that opening day is finally here. I mean, there's such a build-up after, you know, the end of last season, then through spring training, and you have a big acquisition like, you know, pitcher Chris Sale, and everybody wants to see the players here in Boston and in Fenway and enjoy, you know, a beautiful day at the ballpark, and that's
Let me just jump in here. What part of Fenway are you in right now?
I'm a little ways off of, you know, this. I'm on the fifth level, just behind the crowd, and people are, you know, it's the fourth inning. People want to score, so they're getting a little bit excited. I think they also might be getting a little bit cold. I think, you know, the initial enthusiasm is still here, but I see more and more people putting on winter hats.
Oh, come on! No. It's like 50 degrees outside.
If you're sitting in the same place and you're sitting in the shade, it can be a little bit chilly.
That's true. So not the normal hushed tones of the press box. I love the feeling of being there in the middle of all the action. Now, I understand, who threw out the first pitch today? Someone special?
Yeah, that would be Mr. Tom Brady.
Aha.
After some shenanigans with Rob Gronkowski, so they had five representatives of the Patriots come out to throw out the first pitch, and they came out with their Lombardi trophies for all their Super Bowl wins. Tom Brady was here, Rob Gronkowski was here, Dion Lewis was here, James White, and of course, owner Robert Kraft. But before they threw out the opening pitch, Rob Gronkowski stole Tom Brady's jersey, a little bit of a nod to the... something might be happening here. but a little bit to a nod to... Tom Brady's jersey actually getting stolen at the Super Bowl, and then Tom Brady tackled Rob Gronkowski in the outfield and got his jersey back. So some shenanigans before the game.
And shenanigans now, actually, as we hear the cheering behind you. Okay,
yes,
so let's...
the organ playing.
Let's talk about...
What would baseball be without organ playing, right?
Or rambunctious Red Sox fans, let's just put it that way. All right, so this is obviously the first game of the season... The first season the Red Sox have without David Ortiz, but Big Poppy himself actually managed to send an opening day message to the Sox via social media. Here it is.
What's up, Red Sox Nation? You know, I just want to wish my boys good luck this season. Always behind y'all, cheering for your guys. Let's give Red Sox Nation what they deserve. Good luck, guys. Peace.
So, Shira, tell me, though, without Big Poppy, like, how's this year's team shaping up?
I think it's shaping up good. I think people are really looking not so... Well, they're looking to the hitting, but they're also looking to the pitching. They have, you know, Rick Porcello, who's on the mound today. As I mentioned, they acquired Chris Sale from the White Sox in the offseason. That's another big name. And then we're all hoping, or I should say Red Sox Nation is hoping, that David Price will get healthy soon. And that is a fearsome... rotation there, part of a rotation, maybe the best rotation in baseball. So I think people feel very optimistic when they look at their pitching. There is some concern, obviously, about hitting. We're looking at a scoreless game at the moment, and there were certainly a lot of David Ortiz jerseys out and about and around, people wearing them around the ballpark today. So he is very much missed, both on the field and sort of spiritually, because he was the leader of the team as well in terms of, you know, on the field and off the field.
Well, that's Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter, with the plum assignment of the day, I'll say, talking to us from opening day at Fenway Park. Shira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, let's step away from the fun and joy of baseball and to other New England news. Cod stocks in New England are at an historic low, down 80% from a decade ago, according to new data from the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Those findings are being contested by some in the fishing community. Here's Vito Giacalone, policy director for the Northeast Seafood Coalition in Gloucester.
Everyone that fishes the Gulf of Maine, amateur fishermen that go out for the first time, no one can believe that someone can actually say that this cod stock is not in good shape.
Well, joining us now with more is Michael Palmer. He's a research fishery biologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and their lead analyst for the Gulf of Maine cod stock assessment. He also advised the State Division of Marine Fisheries on this new study. Michael Palmer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Megan. Good to be here.
So first of all, what's your reaction to this state study that says cod stocks are down 80%? That seems... enormous. I mean, is it a reasonable number?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's pretty consistent with the signals that we're seeing coming out of our federal surveys. It's also consistent with the stock estimates that are coming out of our population dynamics models. And our population dynamics models are sort of like weather models. They assimilate a lot of information, not just survey information, but information we're collecting directly from the fisheries. And so those stock assessment models are saying the same thing, that the population is at about 75 to 80% of where it was a decade ago.
A decade ago. Okay, so put this in sort of a larger context for us. Is this just sort of the snapshot of a change between 10 years, or if we look further back, are we seeing an overall downward trend?
We're seeing an overall downward trend that's been going on at least since we've been able to achieve population estimates directly from the stocks beginning in the 1980s. We're seeing the numbers now are about at 40,000 metric tons back then is what we were estimating, and now we're seeing about 4,000 metric tons. So it's a fairly considerable decline. Overall, our population sizes are somewhere in the order of 3 to 6% of where we need them to be at sustainable levels.
3 to 6%?
Yeah.
I just, Okay. Well, I mean, obviously, as you know, there are many people in the fishing industry who take exception to these numbers, and they disagree with them. Let's listen to a little bit more from Vito Giacalone. He's the policy director of the Northeast Seafood Coalition, again, based out of Gloucester.
Since around 2001, I would say that the cod stock has been in better shape than we've ever seen it in our lives. Relatively speaking, I mean, I fished heavy in the 80s when supposedly the stock biomass was 20, 30 times greater than it is now. We could never catch the fish in those days that we could catch now.
So, Michael Palmer, why the discrepancy?
We have to keep in mind that, you know, what the commercial fishery primarily is seeing, particularly the day boat fleet out of Gloucester, is they're seeing a fairly limited snapshot of what's going on in the population. Our job as fisheries biologists is to estimate the population size of the entire Gulf of Maine cod stock, and that extends all the way from north of Cape Cod all the way to the Canadian waters. And what we've seen over time, starting in the 1980s, was a loss of cod along the coast of Maine, a loss of cod from the central Gulf of Maine, and there really isn't much of a commercial fishery left there anymore. And so the point of reference for most of the commercial fishery is what's going on in the western Gulf of Maine, and that's an area that still holds cod. And so, you know, the localized abundances that the industry is seeing are not inconsistent with the signals that are coming out of our survey and not inconsistent with the signals coming out of the Mass Division Marine Fisheries Survey. Those are areas that we're still seeing some cod, but overall the population is in poor health.
I see. Okay, so give us then a sense. I mean, these are complex ecosystems, but you're talking about basically a 30-year, 35-year decline that's brought us down to 3% of what we need to be at for sustainable stocks. I mean, what are the major drivers here?
It's difficult to say. I mean, managing fish stocks is a complicated business, and you know, fish populations are affected by a whole host of things, including environmental factors, but also fishing mortality. And unfortunately, the only thing that we can really control is how many fish are getting removed from the population from the fishery, whether that be the commercial fishery or the recreational fishery. And so that's really the tool that fishery managers have available to them, is finding ways to limit the overall cod mortality coming from fishing operations.
Let me just jump in here for a second. I take your point that fishing, the amount of fishing we do is something that we can't control. But you briefly mentioned environmental factors. I mean, is climate change, for example, having an effect on cod stocks?
It could be. It could be. I can't say that we have any concrete evidence of exactly how climate change might be affecting fish stocks. It certainly is. It's an environmental factor, and the amount of young fish that are spawned in the population is affected by things like ocean circulation, temperature. And so those things are all factors, but those things are also very difficult to tease out what's directly relatable to environmental impacts and what's directly related to how much fish are being removed from the population from the fisheries.
Yeah, again, I mean, I fully acknowledge these are complex systems that we're talking about here, but is there the possibility that even, say, we reduced the allowable catch even further, that if there are these other possible environmental factors, that that's not going to help stave off that downward trend?
It's always possible.
That's worrisome, isn't it?
It is very worrisome, and it's an unfortunate situation. I mean, one of the things we try to do is manage these stocks at a sustainable level so that they're much larger. And when we have these large populations out there, it sort of hedges your bet against any sort of fluctuations that might be driven by environmental factors. And so when you've got a small population like this, it's much more susceptible to the negative impacts that might be induced by environmental factors.
Hmm. So what would you recommend, finally, that immediate next steps taken? I mean, there's always the call for more research and more data to be collected, but what would you suggest?
Well, I think a lot of the important steps are being taken right now. You know, managers have drastically reduced the quotas on Gulf of Maine cod, and you hope that that's going to be enough. You hope that we're going to get some strong, what we call recruitment, which is, you know, young fish being spawned into the population. And if that's something that we can see in the near term, that gives us an indication that there's going to be, you know, potential future growth to the population. We hope that we're effectively managing the fishery right now. We hope that we've got the quotas set low enough so that we give the population a chance to recover. But there's a little bit of finger crossing as well. If you know, what we expect to be coming into the population as far as incoming young fish doesn't happen, then it means that we might have to reduce the quotas even further.
Hmm. Well, Michael Palmer is a research fishery biologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We've got a link to these new studies that we've been talking about at radioboston.org. Michael Palmer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that more than 2 million people are infected with antibiotic-resistant bacteria every year, and more than 23,000 people die from those infections. Public health leaders worry that the problem of so-called superbugs is only getting worse, which is why governmental and philanthropic groups from the U.S. and U.K. formed a unique public-private partnership to battle the superbug threat. It's called the Combating Antibiotic Resistant Bacteria Biopharmaceutical Accelerator, or CARB-X, for those of us who have a hard time saying its name. And they recently announced their first round of funding, almost $50 million, to develop new drugs and technology to fight these deadly pathogens. Kevin Ouderson is a health law professor at Boston University, and he's the executive director of CARB-X, and he joins us now. Professor Ouderson, welcome back to the show.
I'm glad to be here, but it would be fun to be at Fenway, too.
Indeed. All of us wish we could be at Fenway Park. But let's talk about this, the threat of superbugs that gave rise to the CARB-X accelerator. I mean, first of all, just in your own view, how serious is the problem of these antibiotic-resistant pathogens?
When you talk to doctors who deal with infection in hospitals, many of them are very serious people, and they're very scared. This is the sort of problem that's never the most urgent one. You know, there's always something else that's drawing the attention of a policymaker or whatnot. But this is slowly growing, and it's a menace, not just to, you know, the people that happen to get it, but it really undermines everything we want to do in medicine.
Mm. I mean, I was reading that we're reaching the point where all it'll take is the development of or the resistance of a couple key pathogens, and things like routine surgery could suddenly become, I don't know, a potentially deadly affair just going into the hospital.
I mean, people do things like a hip replacement because it'll make them much more mobile. But they wouldn't do that if we didn't have the safety net of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Same thing with, a cesarean section, right? Would you do that if you could die from an infection? The answer is probably no.
Makes it a very difficult decision, right? Because some of those surgeries also you have to do for the sake of your own life.
Absolutely.
Okay, so obviously there's a global need for a new class, a new group, a new technology around antibiotics. I mean, one of the things that I noticed is that the last time antibiotics were approved, or the last one to make it to market, was 1984. Why so long ago?
Well, just to be precise with the statistic, that's the last time a new class of antibiotics was approved by the FDA. It had been discovered in 1984.
Okay.
So there's a long lag between discovery, and that was for what's called a gram-positive bacteria, which is the easier type to go after. The last time that we had a discovery of a new class of gram-negative that made it all the way to FDA approval was the year that I was born, 1962. Let me tell you, it's a long time ago. And so we're desperately in need, because of resistance, of new classes. And new classes is something we haven't seen in decades.
So here comes along CARB-X. Again, it's called Combating Antibiotic Resistant Bacteria Biopharmaceutical Accelerator. Between the United States and the UK government and philanthropies, what does CARB-X hope to do?
We want to find interesting science that's happening in universities and small companies and help to move them along. You know, the preclinical phases in which they're getting it ready for human testing, there's almost no private money for antibiotic companies in that space. And so a lot of these companies are living on nickels and dimes and duct tape, you know, trying to make things work. And we're showing up with significant amounts of money in order to find the most interesting projects and move them forward.
And some of those interesting projects that you, in this first round of funding, the $48 million?
In just those 11 companies that we've identified for this first round of funding, three of them would be new antibiotic classes against gram negatives. Again, that hasn't happened since 1962. Four are so novel that there's not even a box to put them in. You know, they're very interesting oblique approaches, ways to deal with antibiotic resistance.
Well, one of them includes what? Just boosting the person's own immune system.
That's right, right. Or another one would take older antibiotics and find ways to make them able to penetrate the double cell wall of a gram-negative bacteria. Huh. So interesting ideas.
Yeah. Can I just throw in, there's another one that really caught my eye that isn't necessarily a treatment but a diagnostic tool, right, that would help doctors diagnose within, did I read it right, 60 seconds, a new what the nature of a particular infection was? Well, that's the hope.
We need diagnostics, without a doubt. And this company is called Proteus, is located in Scotland. And they've developed a light-based sensor system for lung infections so that within 60 seconds they could identify the bacteria and whether it was resistant or susceptible to which, you know, antibiotics at the bedside in less than a minute.
Hmm.
So all of this is early-stage research. You know, a lot of it will fail. But the upside of getting just one of these 11 to succeed, I mean, that alone would be one of the most significant advances we've seen in my lifetime.
So there's a profound public interest here in getting these, to accelerate these technologies to a place where they can make a difference. I wanted to follow up with you on something you said a little bit earlier, and that is for most of these companies who would like to do this kind of research, there are very few private dollars. Does that have to do with the fact that even though this is a worldwide problem, antibiotic resistance, the market for it is shaped in a weird way that doesn't actually make it very financial? There aren't good financial incentives to try to make these drugs.
Almost every big company that has looked at this sector has decided to quit. They've decided they can make more money doing cancer or heart disease or any other drug area other than antibiotics. Part of the reason is that it's difficult for a company, you know, or for a doctor to know which antibiotic is the right one at the moment. And so it's not like some other drugs in which you know exactly which expensive drug to take. Our diagnostics are really pretty still primitive. And so it's difficult to find the patients who need specifically your new expensive antibiotic. There's lots of other things that are messed up with that market as well.
So, I mean, in the long run, though, is there anything that CARB-X is doing to change those market fundamentals so that, you know, maybe in the future, the next time we need a new burst of drug development, we're not necessarily going to need this model, that we've changed the basics so that companies want to make these drugs?
There is an effort underway. It's not under CARB-X. CARB-X is funded by BARDA, which is an office within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as well as the Wellcome Trust in England. And together, these are called push incentives. They're ways to push products along the pipeline. But you're right. If we don't fix, you know, the ultimate market, what happens after FDA approval? If we don't find a way for the market to work in that area, then really we've just accelerated companies towards an eventual market failure.
Hmm.
There are efforts underway, both in the United States and Europe. In Europe, it's called Drive AB. In the United States, is being led by the former FDA commissioner under George Bush, Mark McClellan, working out of Duke University. And in both of these groups, both Drive AB in Europe and McClellan in the United States, they're trying to develop something called a market entry reward, something akin to a large prize that would be paid to a company that brought an amazing antibiotic to market.
Oh, interesting. Now, what happens after one of these new drugs or technologies gets developed? And I guess what I mean is part of the reason why we are where we are in terms of the emergence of these highly resistant pathogens is, you know, we've gone through a 50-year period of overprescribing antibiotics. We've made these superbugs.
Right.
Is there anything in CARB-X's purview that's going to try and stop that from happening all over again?
We have some amazing antibiotics that we literally feed, you know, to pigs, right?
Yeah, like the vast majority of antibiotics are used for veterinary purposes in agriculture.
80% by weight in the United States approximately are used in the agriculture and also with our pets. So without a doubt, if we bring something new to market, a brand new antibiotic, a first in class, we do not want to waste it. And so we've baked into our grant, you know, into the contract that we write with these companies, that they have to come up with a plan for stewardship, for appropriate use of their product from day one. And as the product gets closer and closer to the market, they have to make that a more and more complex plan. And here's the kicker. They have to place it on our website. So it's transparent to the world. This is a first. You know, a lot of companies have internal plans with this regard, but they don't necessarily share them in a place where everyone can see them. And so we're hopeful that not just our companies, but other companies in the sector will follow this trend and begin to think from the earliest stages, but most significantly when they're almost ready to enter the market, about how this drug will have access around the world and also stewardship so that it's not wasted.
That's a potential game changer.
I think so. It could change the culture of the way the industry has dealt with these types of products over decades.
But only if the culture on the end user part of the drug development chain has also changed. Like, you know, all those doctors and all those vets and all those companies that are putting all those antibiotics out there, they need to change their behavior. I guess that's we need to change our behavior too.
Yeah, you know, anyone who's had a child, you know, with an ear infection, you know, knows this struggle about what do you do in that sort of situation. The CDC is working hard to try to reduce the unnecessary use. They think in the community, among people like us, it's about 60% is unnecessary. In hospitals, it's something around 50% may still be unnecessary, which is still a shocking number. Without a doubt, we have to do that and what we're doing at CARB-X and something like a market entry reward. This is a hard problem that requires people pulling, multiple people, you know, working together in order to make this a solution.
Well, Kevin Ouderson is a professor of health law at Boston University and executive director of CARB-X. It's a new biopharmaceutical accelerator. It's a public-private partnership that's aiming to help develop the next generation of antibiotics to fight so-called superbugs. Kevin Ouderson, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here and hope no one ever needs one of these new drugs.
Likewise. Well, let's turn now to a different kind of public health crisis, that having to do with opioid abuse and addiction. Public restrooms have become ground zero in the opioid battle as one of the few places where people find privacy to inject. But it's also creating a lot of tension, from needles clogging toilets in fast food restaurants, libraries, and town halls, to nervousness among workers in those places. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has this look from Mass Ave in Cambridge.
So we're going to go check out the place we talked about. It's this way.
A man named Eddie guides me through the mid-afternoon crowd toward a sandwich shop. Some restaurants, offices, and a social service agency here in Central Square have closed their bathrooms to the public in recent months. Not this place. We stop in front of big glass windows.
With these bathrooms here, you don't need a key. You just, if it's vacant, you go in. And then the staff just leaves you alone. I know so many people that get high here.
At the fast food place right across the street, it's much harder to get in and out.
You don't need a key, but they have a security guard that sits at the little table by the door directly from the bathroom.
Some guards require a receipt for admission to the bathroom, Eddie says, but you can grab one from the trash. Eddie, who's 39 and homeless, works in a restaurant himself. We're only using his first name because he's admitting to illegal drug use. Eddie is on methadone, which curbs his craving for heroin, so he only uses occasionally to be social with friends. Our next stop, a national burrito chain.
So now, like, this place, you have to get the code to use their bathroom. But if you go in there and sit on that side by the bathroom, if you wait long enough, someone's going to use that bathroom, and then you'll say, hey, hold the door for me, and then you're in.
So you know which bathrooms
I do. I do. I know all the bathrooms that I can and can't get high in. Even in the train station downstairs, you can use that bathroom most days and not be bothered.
So that's not good in some ways, right?
It's not good at all, because who's keeping an eye on them? That's why you have to have somebody with you to make sure that you don't overdose. It's unfortunate that it's come to that, but that's the way it is.
You can understand why the restaurants might be freaked out about this, right?
Absolutely. I mean, these businesses primarily are like family businesses. They don't expect to find somebody dead, so I get it.
But what are businesses supposed to do? Some have installed low lighting, blue in particular, to make it difficult for drug users to find a vein. But Joshua Gerber, who owns the 1369 Coffee House, is focused on keeping all of his customers safe. He's drilled a metal box into the wall next to his toilet for needles and other things that clog pipes. And Gerber removed the drop ceilings in his bathrooms after noticing things tucked above the tiles.
We'd find needles or people's drugs. It's a tricky thing managing a public restroom in a big, busy square like Central Square where there's a lot of drug use.
Gerber and his staff have found several people on the bathroom floor not breathing.
And it's very scary, you know. In an ideal world, users would have safe places to go, that it didn't become the job of a business to manage that and to look after them and make sure that they were okay.
There are no such safe use spaces in Massachusetts or anywhere in the U.S. So Gerber is taking the unusual step of training his baristas to use naloxone, the drug that reverses most opioid overdoses. He sent a training invitation email to all employees last week. Within 10 minutes, he had about 25 replies.
Mostly capital yes, exclamation point, you know, I'll be there for sure, count me in, you know, just thrilled to figure out how they might be able to save a life.
Naloxone has become standard equipment for security guards at many hospitals in the Boston area.
I carry it on me every day. It's right here in a little pouch.
Ryan Curran, a police and security operations manager at Mass General, stands outside a bathroom in the main lobby where a woman OD'd last fall. She survived, as have 7 or 8 people who overdosed in MGH bathrooms since Curran's team started carrying naloxone in the last year or year and a half.
It's definitely relieving when you know and you see someone breathing again when 2-3 minutes beforehand they looked lifeless and then a couple pumps in the nasal spray and they're doing better. It's pretty incredible.
Mass General started training security guards after emergency room physician Dr. Ali Raja realized the hospital's bathrooms had become a magnet for some of his overdose patients.
There's an understanding that if you overdose in and around a hospital, that you're much more likely to be able to be treated. And so we're finding patients in our restrooms. We're finding patients in our lobbies.
Many businesses, including hospitals and clinics, don't want to talk about overdoses within their buildings. And Raja and Curran at Mass General want to be sure their message on drug use is clear. Here's Curran again.
We don't want to promote, obviously, people coming here and using it. But if it's going to happen, then we'd like to be prepared to help them and save them and get them to the ED as fast as possible.
Speed is critical, especially now when heroin is routinely mixed with fentanyl. Some clinics and restaurants check on bathroom users by having staff knock on the door after 10 or 15 minutes. But fentanyl can lead to oxygen-deprived brain death within that window. One clinic has installed an intercom and requires people to respond. Another has just designed a reverse motion detector that sets off an alarm if there's no movement in the bathroom. During an epidemic, you might think public health officials would issue safety practices for bathrooms, but Boston Medical Center's Dr. Alex Wally says no one wants to talk about their strategies in public.
It's against federal and state law to provide a space where people can use knowingly. So that is a big deterrent from people talking about this problem.
Without some guidance, more libraries, town halls, and businesses are closing their bathrooms to the public. That means more drug use, injuries, and discarded needles in parks and on city streets. But keeping bathrooms open by stocking naloxone and monitoring who goes in and for how long is a challenge for many businesses. Daniel Raymond with the New York-based Harm Reduction Coalition says more communities are reaching a breaking point with bathrooms.
Having dedicated facilities like safer drug consumption spaces is the best bet for a long-term structural solution that I think a lot of business owners could buy into.
Maybe. No business groups in Massachusetts have come out in favor of rooms in which users could inject drugs under the supervision of a doctor or nurse. But there is a lot of frustration about how to manage bathrooms.
That report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Back in 2010, Eric Schmidt, then CEO of Google, had a vision for a personalized web. He said in a Wall Street Journal interview that one day, technology will be so good, it will be very hard for people to watch or consume something that has not, in some sense, been tailored for them. Of course, Schmidt was exactly right. Netflix, Pandora, Google News, etc. But according to Harvard Law professor Cass Sunstein, that personalization, especially on social media, has also isolated us, polarized our political parties, and divided our democracy. Sunstein has a remedy for this. It's in his new book called Hashtag Republic, Divided Democracy in the Age of Social Media. And he joins us now. Professor Sunstein, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Now, of course, social media, fake news, all of this has been on top of mind for many people recently. But I'm just curious, how much of a threat, honestly, do you think all this is to the fundamentals of our democracy?
Significant. On a scale of 1 to 100, 63.
Wow. And I mean,
not 90, but significant.
Higher than 50. And why? 50. Why do you think our democracy isn't resilient enough in the face of social media?
I think our democracy is very resilient. But if you go back to the founding, there's a lot of talk about Hamilton these days. And Hamilton's great contribution to kind of thinking about government was the jarring of parties and diversity of view can promote deliberation and circumspection. So America has really prospered when people who think lots of different things are talking to one another respectfully, in contact with each other, sometimes compromising, but always learning. And if you have a system where people are self-segregating into echo chambers of, you know, I like Senator Sanders and I think Donald Trump is fantastic, and those who disagree with me are, you know, very badly confused or maybe worse, then our ability to get along with each other and to come up with productive solutions will be significantly reduced.
Mm. Now, how do you see then this polarization being amplified further via social media?
Well, what we know is that if groups of people clump together with others who agree with them, three things happen. First, they get more confident. Second, they get more unified. And third, they get more extreme. And because on Facebook and Twitter, and I should say I use and like them both, it's really easy to clump with like-minded people, you know, to follow or just to read stuff that fits with your own preconceptions. You can get a really aggravated form of kinds of group polarization that have sometimes served democracies very poorly, where you get, in the worst cases, cults that are likely to consider violence, and in the less bad but also not good cases where people are clumping together and thinking of their fellow citizens as traitors or enemies.
Hmm. I'm curious, I mean, I want to get to some of your solutions here in just a minute, but how demonstrably different do you think this world that we live in via social media is now than it was, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Because in a sense, you know, from the advent of cable television, we had the opportunity to immerse ourselves in the bubbles of our choosing.
You're right. It's not a radical break, but it is a difference in degree. So if you think of X number of years ago where there was a degree of nicheification, let's say, compared to 20 or 30 years before that, you still had a situation where on the outlet you chose, you'd get some topics that kind of serendipitously would come in front of your eyes. Or you get points of view sometimes on maybe you're watching a left of center station, but they're going to say some conservative things, and that will bring you up short, make you think something different. So what we have now with social media is more than at any time in human history, there's a capacity to create not serendipity, but control over your communications universe. You can live in a kind of cocoon, which is really cozy and pleasing, but which might turn out to be a prison.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons why I see this lack of serendipity, as you put it, being a particular problem in this day and age is that there are other forces, you know, offline forces in the United States that already make it harder for people to interact just in real life on a day-to-day basis with folks outside their immediate, you know, socioeconomic status, their preferred political party or viewpoint. I mean, there is polarization just within neighborhoods and how people live in the United States that's being further amplified by their online world.
You're completely right. So there's some research on geographical sorting where people used to be more mixed in terms of the political complexity, let's say, of their neighborhood. And now it may be that it's just uniform. It's all the Republicans together and all the Democrats together. We also see an increase in people's concern if it turned out that their child married someone of a different political party. So now a lot more Americans would be worried about someone marrying someone of a different political party than would be worried about someone marrying someone of a different race. Now, that's progress along one dimension.
Right.
Great progress.
Right.
People are okay with racial intermarriage. But it's not so good if a Republican family thinks, oh, my gosh, my daughter might marry a Democrat.
Yeah. Well, in your book, Hashtag Republic, you come back a few times to what I think is a very important area of worthy of exploration, and that is the tension between what we as individuals may want from our online world versus what is good for democracy, right? I mean, you talk about two different concepts of sovereignty, consumer versus political. Explain that.
Okay, so the great idea in a market economy is that consumers are sovereign in the sense that you can choose whatever you want, and you know, the company that sells sneakers or cell phones isn't sovereign over you in the sense that you can just say, no, I'm going to go elsewhere. And that idea values certain kind of norms. Usually, does this please me? Does that cell phone or that sneaker please me? The idea of citizen sovereignty is that we, the people, are in charge of our society. And as a consumer, you might think something. You know, you might say, as a consumer, I'm not going to buy a product, even though it's not good for endangered animals. I don't care so much about that as a consumer. But as a citizen, you might say, you know, an Endangered Species Act is a pretty good idea, and I'm going to support that. And I think the Silicon Valley conception of freedom, which, you know, captures a lot of the picture, just not all of it. The Silicon Valley conception of freedom is just consumer sovereignty, rather than thinking that we can kind of figure out together, so long as we respect liberty and such, what our society is going to look like. And that triggers some values and aspirations, which when we're going to the supermarket, we may not have foremost in our minds.
Mm-hmm. And so then how to remove those competing or lessen those competing forces if we're talking about enhancing the concept of citizenship or citizen sovereignty online?
Well, there are two kind of avenues. One is, let's just take Facebook as an example, and as I say, I'm a fan, but it has a newsfeed, which really is the consumer sovereignty picture, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what do you want to see right now? That's for you. And there's a lot of good in that, but the news feed that is provided, let's say, by your favorite newspaper, and I'll say it right now, the Boston Globe, it's not just thinking, what do I personally want to see right now? It's thinking, you know, what's our responsibility as a newspaper? And that means that people see topics and points of view that maybe they didn't particularly want to see right then. And Facebook could go more in the direction, let's say, of a great newspaper or a great magazine or a great city, which just has serendipity in it. And if this seems kind of pie in the sky, it might not be, because Facebook has been talking publicly recently in a way that suggests it's reevaluating what it's going to conceive of its newsfeed as. Hmm. For each of us, it depends on what culture we live in, really. And whatever your political view, you might think, you know, I live in a society where half of the country is nuts, and thank goodness I'm going to not read that nuttiness. Or you could think that, you know, we're kind of all in this together, and as a great judge said in World War II, the spirit of liberty is that spirit which is not too sure that it's right. And I have something to learn from a lot of different voices, and I won't know unless I kind of try to hear them.
Yeah. You know, Professor Sunstein, I think you make an excellent point here, but this is exactly why I have to be perfectly honest. I'm a little cynical about relying on companies like Facebook to evolve for the better good of their own accord. And it's not because I think anything nefarious is going on. It's just that we are dealing with very enormous, powerful companies that have to create shareholder value. And we know that in social media, the way to do that is to keep people engaged, right? That prize of engagement. And people stay engaged when they're served up with content that they like, that mirrors their world back to them. So it's a really, really powerful force in opposition to the serendipity that you're calling for.
Well, you have a point. And in the end, you know, it may be that the profit motive is a real challenge for those who seek more serendipity. But a couple points the other way. One is that if you look at the great companies, they have often found ways to promote a range of values consistent with maximizing shareholder value, which are less kind of short-term than you might think. So whether it's an automobile company that is trying to produce the safest automobiles on the market and more energy efficient than they were a decade ago, or whether it's a soft drink company that's moving, you know, maybe not as aggressively as some people would like, but which is definitely moving in the direction of more concern for public health, or whether it's a hospital that is concerned about money, but that's serving a lot of people who don't have a nickel, really. So the companies often have a diverse range of values. And the other point is that as much as human beings often like to clump together with people who think what they do, that can get really boring. To look in a mirror all the time, even if you like how you look, can get old. And so I think there's a lot of money to be had by appealing to that characteristic of our species, which probably most distinguishes us from other species, and that's curiosity.
Yeah. You know, you're one of the leaders of this idea of sort of nudge, or behavioral economics, right, where we can come up with sort of a less obvious ways to produce small ways to produce major changes in behaviors in people and systems. So I'm wondering what's the nudge solution here for democracy and social media?
Well, I think for social media to give people an opportunity to opt in to something that involves surprises or something that involves opposing views would be a step forward. And what we've seen in the last few months even, it's really recent, is lots of technological whizzes devising stuff like this, where you can get an app which is freestanding, which will kind of measure whether you're seeing lots of different views, or whether you can get apps that will interact with Facebook to kind of show you what you're seeing and maybe provide you with stuff that's different from what you're seeing. So that's a direction. It's in the nature of a nudge. Facebook could provide something, you know, an opposing viewpoint button or a serendipity mm-hmm. button, or you'd even call it a Hamilton button. And I think we're going to see stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, just to plug a fellow WBUR reporter here, Asma Khalid, she's the head of our Bostonomics team. Just this week, she had a story about exactly this, about folks at MIT and Harvard who were coming up with Chrome plugins, for example, that can, one of them's called Flip Feed, where you see the Twitter feed from someone in another or a hypothetical person in another part of the country, different political perspectives, just to get sort of immersed in what their social media reality is like. And we will put a link to Asma's piece at our website, radioboston.org. But finally, Professor Sunstein, we're just sort of scratching the surface of what you have to offer here in your book. And I just want to, in the last couple seconds that we have, ask you, you write this very powerful sentence early in the book. You say, to date, social media have not helped produce civil war, but that day will probably come. Is that really the future that you foresee if we don't do something?
Well, I don't think in the United States we're going to see civil war, but it is probably the case that some sort of outbreak in violence will at some point or another be promoted by social media. And I don't think it's a large scale of civil war with a capital C, capital W, but you know, we've seen certainly uses of social media to promote terrorism. Our government's been very worried about that. Twitter and Facebook have themselves been very, very worried about that for recruitment of people and radicalization. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically social media are good, but so are cars and cell phones, and all three have downsides.
Well, Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School, and his new book is Hashtag Republic, Divided Democracy in the Age of Social Media. Professor Sunstein, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Well, in the last minute that we have, we started the hour at Fenway Park, and it was 0-0 at that time. And Shira Springer, WBR Sports and Society reporter, is there again with us now. We've got 30 seconds, Shira. Something amazing happened in the past 45 minutes.
Yeah, Andrew Benintendi, let me try to say that correctly because we'll be saying his name a lot in the future. He is a rookie, and he hit a three-run homer in the bottom of the fifth, and the Red Sox are now ahead 5-0. So the crowd was going wild, I think in part because they were so eager to get some runs on the scoreboard, but also because they see Benintendi as the next great Red Sox superstar. He's already the preseason favorite to win the 2017 Rookie of the Year Award. He's only 22 years old,
yeah.
So he could be around and hitting home runs for quite some time in Fenway Park.
Well, Twitter told me he hit it off a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, too. Shira Springer, thanks so much.
Yes.
This is Radio Boston.
Thank you.